From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, projections of what war might be like in the Gulf, and a look at the resistance at home. Retired Rear Admiral Gene LaRocque is the founder of the Center for Defense Information, which monitors the Pentagon. He says Bush administration projections of American war casualties are overly optimistic. David McReynolds has worked with the War Resisters League for 30 years. The group is counseling men and women in the military who don't want to fight in the Gulf. Also, we call Israel to speak with the leader of the group, Peace Now. And we talk with the head of clergy and laity concerned about the deadline for war coinciding with the birth date of Martin Luther King. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Diplomats are appealing to Iraq to relent as the final hours tick away toward the deadline for Iraq to pull out of Kuwait. But Baghdad has rebuffed the pleas. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says President Bush is at peace with himself and is ready to make tough decisions. Fitzwater says an attack is likely to come sooner rather than later. World financial markets are mostly quiet. Investors are sitting out the deadline. Oil prices were down slightly. The dollar is mostly lower, and trading on Wall Street is light. French Prime Minister Michel Rocard has accused Baghdad of turning down all offers of dialogue. Yesterday, the French came up with a last-minute peace plan that it hoped would avert war in the Gulf. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
The French government has said it would work for peace until the last minute, and that's exactly what it's done. Last night, the government presented a peace plan to UN Security Council members. The plan calls for Iraq to announce its withdrawal from Kuwait, and in exchange, it says a Middle East peace conference should take place sometime in the future. The government said if Iraq accepted the plan, the French foreign minister would go to Baghdad, but now that looks very unlikely. Prime Minister Michel Rocard said Iraq had rejected the plan. He said the time to use force to get Iraq out of Kuwait had come. Several hours ago, the government decided to close its embassy in Baghdad. All other Western countries have already closed their embassies there, but the French have been keeping theirs open in hopes that a peace initiative would avert a war. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
At the United Nations, Britain has proposed a last-minute appeal calling on Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Just hours before the UN deadline for Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait, Britain is seeking approval from the UN Security Council for a brief statement to be delivered by the council president. The statement makes a solemn appeal for Iraq to display what it calls wisdom and responsibility and to take the only necessary step. That step, the statement says, is to withdraw unconditionally from Kuwait. The statement says that if Iraqi President Saddam Hussein does this, he can still avert war. The British proposal came as Prime Minister John Major addressed the House of Commons, saying that while Britain is not thirsting for war, if it comes, it would be a just war. Major's address was interrupted by anti-war protesters who threw a red substance that fell on some members of Parliament. This is Brian Naylor in London.
The United States has recalled all non-essential diplomatic personnel and their families from Pakistan and the Sudan as a result of the conflict in the Persian Gulf. The State Department is recommending that all other U.S. citizens leave those countries as soon as possible. Anti-American demonstrations in Pakistan have increased over the past 4 days. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 4.7 points at 2488.61. Trading is still light. 107 million shares have changed hands. You're listening to National Public Radio News. The American Red Cross says it's sending an additional 91 workers to the Persian Gulf to join 54 staffers already there. The Red Cross has relayed 64,000 messages between U.S. troops in the Gulf and their families. For the past month, the organization has been shipping 1,000 pints of blood each week to the area. It is the first time since World War II that the U.S. military has called on the American Red Cross to supply blood in a time of impending military conflict. The leadership of the nation's largest Indian tribe will be turned over to a new tribal president today. Former Chairman Peterson Zah will be inaugurated as the Navajo's first elected president since government reforms were adopted a year ago. George Hardin reports from Tuba City, Arizona.
Peterson Zah returns to head the Navajo tribe today after losing the chairmanship to suspended Navajo Chairman Peter McDonald 4 years ago. As Zah takes the oath of office, McDonald is involved in the second of three corruption trials in the Navajo courts. In October, He was convicted on 41 counts of taking bribes and kickbacks from contractors. McDonald was suspended by the Navajo Tribal Council in 1989, although he has declared his innocence of any wrongdoing to this day. Zaw takes over at a time when the Navajo tribe's credibility among business people is in ruins. With more than a third of the 160,000 Navajos unemployed, he says he hopes to revive interest in the tribe as a business partner and unify the badly divided Navajos. For National Public Radio, I'm George Hardeen in Tuba City, Arizona.
Two senior leaders of the Palestine Liberation Organization were assassinated last night in Tunisia by their bodyguard. One of the victims is the second-in-command of the PLO, Abu Iyad, deputy to PLO leader Yasser Arafat. The other is Hayal Abdel Hamid, the security chief of the PLO. Abu Iyad's aide was killed as well. The PLO has not ruled out Israel as a culprit, but Israel says it had nothing to do with it. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Bush has said if we go to war, it will not be another Vietnam. We'll get in and out quick. Les Aspin, chair of the House Armed Services Committee, in his recent white paper, said there was a good chance of a rapid American victory in less than a month, with 3,000 to 5,000 casualties and 500 to 1,000 dead. These projections are overly optimistic, according to my guest, retired Rear Admiral Jean Larocq. Larocq is the founder of the Center for Defense Information, an independent research organization which analyzes military spending, policies, and weapons systems. The staff includes retired military officers, as well as civilians with extensive training in military analysis. Larocq began his naval service in 1940, and during his 31 years in active service, he commanded a variety of warships, including destroyers and guided missile cruisers. For 7 years, he worked in the Pentagon on strategic planning for the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Chief of Naval Operations. Larocq retired from the military in 1972, the year he founded the Center for Defense Information. I spoke to him earlier today from his office in Washington, D.C. He told me he's opposed to war in the Gulf. I asked him to compare his war projections with those of the president and Les Aspin.
Well, we think the war will last at least 3 months and probably 6 months. The casualty figures be considerably higher. Doing all of our arithmetic based on our historical experience and all the tables from the various conflicts that the United States and other nations have been involved in, it would appear to us that we'll have 10,000 dead American servicemen and women, 35,000 wounded, maimed. We will also then have about 35,000 Iraqi dead military, with another 100,000 wounded. We also anticipate that we will cause casualties, both dead and wounded, among 100,000 Iraqi civilians. So all in all, we will cause casualties to about 250,000 civilians and military in Iraq, and 45,000 for the United States, 10,000 of whom will be dead. It's not difficult to make a composite of once you have decided on the scenario. Our scenario, our attack, is to go and capture Baghdad, and we think that comports with what President Bush has said we're going to have to do, since the status quo ante, the conditions that prevailed before this happened, he says cannot be sustained.
So you're convinced that fighting won't be contained to Kuwait. You think that the United States would go into Iraq?
Oh, it has to, because Kuwait's only 100 miles long and 50 miles wide. If we put our whole 500,000 troops into Kuwait and then made the rest of Iraq as a sanctuary, that would be militarily ridiculous. President Bush has said that we're going to have to punish aggression. You can't do that simply by marching into Kuwait, occupying Kuwait, and then sitting on the sand 10 feet away from the Iraqis in the sand on the other side of the border.
My guest is retired Rear Admiral Eugene Larocq. He's founder of the Center for Defense Information, which is an organization of retired senior military officers dedicated to monitoring Pentagon weapon systems, spending, and policies. To give us a sense of proportion, would you compare the American deployment in the Gulf today to the American deployment in World War II in Vietnam?
Well, in World War II, we had 13 million men under arms, so it's, this is much, much smaller. However, in Vietnam, we had about the same number of troops. But the big difference is simply this. In Vietnam, it took us about 4 years to build up to 500,000. And in that time, we built up a logistics train. We had things well organized with the medical facilities. We had actually some pretty decent hospitals and hospital ships. In this situation, we have rushed over there, thrown these temporary structures up in the sand, and are improvising a logistics system to provide the food, the water, the medical supplies, the petroleum, all the spare parts for our fighting forces. And it's been a group that has put together like a sandlot ball team. In Vietnam, it was a gradual, organized, well-orchestrated buildup. This is entirely different over here, and we're going to face an entirely different and, I think, more formidable adversary.
How would you compare the relative strength and weaknesses of the United States and Iraqi military?
Well, let me give you a couple of advantages that the Iraqis have. First of all, numerically, they're superior to us.
In what? Ground troops?
Well, in troops, total troop structure. We'll have at the most 430,000 troops on our side. That's the only troops we can count on. We can't count on the Moroccans and the Bangladeshis and the Egyptians and the Syrians. So our forces, 430,000 plus 30,000 from the British who will be fighting under our command. The others won't fight, or if they do, they'll fight independently. So we numerically, the Iraqis are superior. Secondly, the Iraqis will be defending their homeland and their families. Thirdly, the Iraqis are dug in. They had 5 months now to dig in the sand, and that makes a very difficult target to root out. The Iraqis have had 8 years of wartime experience. We've not had any wartime experience for those folks over there, except for the senior officers who fought in the jungles of Vietnam. The Iraqis have chemical weapons, which, even if they don't use them, presents a burden for us because we will have to be prepared for their use. I got a picture from my son over there in the desert. He didn't have a hat on. He didn't have any sidearms. By golly, he had his gas mask strapped to his belt, and it's a clear indication that we're expecting an attack. So that'll slow down our forces. And then finally, I would say that the Iraqis have an advantage because if they're killed in this, they're going to go to heaven. Our troops, on the contrary, are going to be fighting in a strange land without any battle experience. We don't know if our equipment will work. We hope it will. Our troops have been well trained. I don't want to denigrate them in any way, but when you look at this from the point of view of the purely cold, analytical situation, it means that the Iraqis are going to be a very formidable foe. We're going to have a tough time whipping them. We'll do it, but it'll take time and great cost.
Admiral LaRocque, I didn't realize you had a son who was in the Gulf.
Oh, yes, yes. The other son fought in Vietnam. We're a military family.
Admiral LaRocque, what is your son's position in the military?
He's a commander, a Navy doctor with the Marines, right on the front lines in Saudi Arabia, ready to take care of all the people who presumably will be injured. I got a letter from him last night, and he said that there's a tremendous amount of weaponry pouring into the place, and he said it looks like we're on the verge of a major battle.
Does he share your opinion that war is inappropriate and unnecessary?
Well, he's a doctor, and he looks at it from the point of view of taking care of the troops. He's an excellent doctor. He likes his patients. I don't know that I could characterize him one way or the other. I know that my son got two Purple Hearts in Vietnam, part of his leg blown off. He's very patriotic. He never got turned off on things. On the other hand, he thinks this war is certainly not worth it, and maiming and killing a lot more Americans.
I'd like to get back to something you were saying earlier. You said that you thought Iraqi had a superior land force, that Iraqi troops outnumbered American troops. But in the air, doesn't America have superiority over Iraq, and wouldn't America be likely to use an air attack as its first strike?
Of course. We have 1,300 aircraft over there, all very fine aircraft, and the Iraqis have about 600. although the Iraqi aircraft are all supersonic, modern airplanes from France and the Soviet Union. We will gain air superiority in the first 3 or 4 days. We'll get complete control of the air by D plus 7 or 8 days, and we'll be able to roam freely about with our aircraft attacking targets as we wish. So it will be a very powerful component of our armed forces. But we still, at some point, are going to have to go to those sand dunes and dig out those Iraqis who are there with the heavy artillery, with tanks, with rifles, and that's not going to be easy.
It's been reported that the Pentagon's worst fear is of trench war. Why would that be their worst fear, and what would lead to trench warfare?
Well, the trench warfare is exactly the technique that the Iraqis used in the war with Iran. That's why the Pentagon's concerned, and that's what the Iraqis have been doing for 5 months now, is digging into the sand. And it's going to be very difficult for us to knock them out with air attacks or with artillery. The only way we're ultimately going to solve the problem or destroy them is to go in and root them out. Trench warfare we've not had really since, in any significant way, since World War I. But the history of the Iran-Iraq war has been how clever, how professional the Iraqis were on the defense, and the way they dug in, and sure, the Pentagon's worried about it. They ought to be.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is retired Rear Admiral Gene LaRocque, and he's the founder of the Center for Defense Information. It's an organization of retired senior military officers dedicated to monitoring Pentagon weapon systems, spending, and policies. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Retired Rear Admiral Eugene LaRocque is my guest of the Center for Defense Information. He's speaking to us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. Getting back to desert warfare, the other day on our program we were speaking with a Soviet journalist who covered the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And he said that Soviet soldiers there had a lot of problems with the boots that they were issued. Sand was always getting in their shoes. It would cut their feet up into meat. He said that there are no maps that really help you navigate your way through the desert. Troops get lost. It's hard to identify your enemy in the desert. It's easy for them to get lost and out of your sight. Do you think that these are problems that we might be facing?
Absolutely true. We do have desert boots, however, so I would hope they don't get too much sand in the boots of the American soldiers. But that terrain is flat. There aren't any road maps. Historically, even when we fought in Europe, literally, our troops had to get local gas station maps to get from one place to the other and rely on road signs and talk to the natives. None of that's going to be available for our forces over there. Yes, we won't be able to separate friend from foe in many cases. It's compounded by the fact that not only do we have Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps forces all there on the ground under a commander which has not had those forces under his command, and they've all been drawn from disparate units around the United States to make up this team, we further compound it by having forces from about 13 countries that are there with different languages, different radio frequencies. It's going to be very difficult just to separate out a friend from foe in the air or from tanks. So it could be very complicated. Normally in a war, you have about a significant amount of fratricide, that is, friendly fire killing your own troops. Well, I think we can look for more friendly fire killing friendly troops in this war than perhaps we've had in the past, because there's no overall commander. These are forces just been thrown in from various countries around the world, not under any single command. This is not a United Nations commander. The French, the Egyptians, the Syrians, who make up the next large bulk of forces, They're totally independent. They'll fight or not fight when they want to and the way they want to fight. And so the best we could hope for is some modicum of cooperation so that we don't end up shooting each other.
How much are we relying on untested weapons in the Gulf? And what can some of these weapons do that we've never done before? What kind of new things can they do for us?
Well, we've never used any of these weapons that we have over there in this environment. And most of these weapons were designed to fight in Europe, an entirely different environment. We don't know whether our helicopters, the Apaches, which have always had problems anyhow, are going to function because of the sand. We don't know if our night vision glasses and goggles will work well if the sand creates a problem for them. We have the anti-aircraft Patriot missile, which is designed to shoot down airplanes. We're hoping maybe it will shoot down some of those Scud missiles also. We will be flying the F-117s, the stealth fighters. They were sort of tested a little bit in Panama. They missed their target, but that was the first time that they were used, and that's to be expected. We don't know how well they're going to do, and we don't know how well those stealth fighters will fit into the environment over there, because the stealth fighters are designed to slip in under the radar, and that will confuse our radars as well as the Iraqi radars. And our main battle tanks, of which we have probably will have at least 1,000 of those over there, we don't know how well they're going to perform in combat. We do know that for every 158 hours of operation, that M1 battle tank historically has broken down for one reason or another. We have to supply those main battle tanks with fuel. A tanker literally has to accompany every one of those tanks, or at least a tanker has to go along with the tank forces, several tankers, because those M1 tanks, our most modern tanks, take 3 gallons of fuel for each mile the tank traverses. So it takes a lot of fuel to keep those going, and if we have trouble with our tankers, it's going to be a problem.
Do you think there's any possibility that the United States or Israel would use a tactical nuclear weapon war?
I hate the term tactical. A nuclear weapon is, like Gertrude Stein said, is a nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon. They just vary a little bit in size, but they're nasty, brutal things. Our government, of course, has said we will not use nuclear weapons, no matter what, in the area. And I think that was maybe an unnecessary statement, because if you're going into battle, I don't think I'd want to tell an adversary you're not going to use some of your weapons. On the other hand, I think the opprobrium attached to our use of nuclear weapons in that area would be so great in the world that it would be a huge, colossal mistake to use nuclear weapons in that area. I don't know about the Iraqi or the Israelis. I don't think Saddam Hussein is going to attack Israel once the war starts, in spite of the fact that Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz said he would, because I don't think the Iraqis are so dumb as to open up another front, as it were, to entice the Israelis to attack them when Iraq will already be fighting against the Americans.
But on the other hand, if Israel did attack, the Arab alliance with the United States could fall apart, and that would be to the strategic advantage of Iraq.
Oh, it would be of some nuisance value, but not significant, because the America has enough forces over there to fight the war all by itself. As a matter of fact, some of those forces, the Moroccans, the Bangladeshis, with a couple thousand troops in the area, are probably more of a nuisance than they are of a help. They take time to give a job to and to monitor. The United States is fully prepared to fight this war all by itself. We don't need those modest forces from the other countries. They're wonderful for symbology. We like the symbolic presence because it makes us feel comfortable that we're not in this war all by ourselves, when as a matter of fact, we are.
Retired Rear Admiral Eugene LaRocque is my guest, the founder of the Center for Defense Information. How did a career military man like yourself become so averse to the idea of war?
Well, I know war. I have fought wars. I've planned wars, both the conventional and nuclear war. I know how nasty and brutal it can be. There are times when you use and need to use military force to defend your country, to support and carry out a treaty agreement, or to defend Americans in foreign countries. But to send military forces, sacrifice the lives of our troops for oil or for some vague reason makes no sense to me. I want to save our military force for the purpose for which it was intended, and that's primarily to defend the United States. We're not the policemen of the world. It is not our job to go to each one of the 160 countries of the world and to force them to see things the way we want them done.
What do you think the most likely scenario would be if war starts? You know, how war would start?
Well, we're going to go to war again. The cannons are cocked, as I said, and the ships are in place, and the planes are ready to take off. The war plans have been made. We're going to war, and we're going to go to war, it seems to me, about the 20th of this month. Not before, but about the 20th, after we have scared the Iraqis for 4 or 5 days, then we'll suddenly attack. The war will last about 3 months. It's going to be a war which ultimately we will defeat the armed forces of Iraq, but we won't win anything. As a matter of fact, we're going to have a very costly period afterwards. I could leave you on this one note. We must never forget this, that there are in Iraq today 1 million men and women armed with rifles and have bullets with them. Even if we are able to persuade the government of Iraq to cry uncle and quit, those hundreds of thousands of Iraqis will still have their rifles and their bullets, and we're going to be fighting an insurgency there for years and years to come.
Why do you think the United States would wait till around the 20th to actually attack?
Well, from a military point of view, minute the deadline is up, the Iraqis will have their fingers on the trigger. They're going to be ready there for us to attack. And I would say that it would be smart of General Schwarzkopf and smart military to threaten to indicate as though we're launching an attack. Send planes toward the Iraqis for 4 or 5 days. Keep them on their toes until they become a little careless. And then one of those times, our planes keep right on going and attack Iraq, and we'll catch them off guard that way. To me, that's a smart military maneuver, plus the fact it's pretty clear we don't have all our forces in place yet, so a few extra days would be good. Plus the fact that I think President Bush may be getting some second thoughts and say, well, maybe if I wait a few days, Saddam Hussein might cave in after all.
Is this a scenario you'd recommend, or is this a scenario you think the American military will actually follow?
I'd recommend it, and I think they're smart enough to follow it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure being with you. I hate to be sort of a spoil sport, but it looks to me like we're going to be in combat for a long, nasty, brutal war in the next week.
My guest has been retired Rear Admiral Jean LaRocque, founder of the Center for Defense Information. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As we move closer to war, we talk with leaders of groups working for peace. We call Israel to discuss the Gulf crisis with Janet Aviat of the group Peace Now. David McReynolds of the War Resisters League, headquartered in Manhattan, shares the advice his group is giving to military men and women who don't want to fight in the Gulf. And we remember the other reason January 15th is significant, the birthday of Martin Luther King. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. France is conceding that its last-minute peace plan before the United Nations has fallen through. A government spokesman in Paris says that opposition by the United States and Great Britain was insurmountable. The British have proposed an alternative plan calling for a Security Council appeal to Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait. As the deadline nears, the Gulf region is preparing for war. Security is being tightened in Arab states, and people are hoarding food and other staples, according to Arab news sources. In Baghdad, thousands of protesters marched through the streets and burned U.S. flags. Egypt's news agency says many Baghdad residents are fleeing the city. The State Department says diplomacy to avoid war in the Persian Gulf is at a dead end. The department once again rejected any overtures that would provide Iraq with concessions for pulling out of Kuwait. Barry Schwide reports.
All the State Department would go for is a British proposal that simply summarizes the 12 U.N. Security Council resolutions designed to get Iraq out of Kuwait. Secretary of State James Baker gave British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd a green light in a telephone conversation to have Britain present the proposal to the U.N. Security Council. Otherwise, calls for a Mideast peace conference by France and others were flatly rejected by the Bush administration with a now familiar objection that they were forms of linkage, tying a pullout to the Palestinian issue. In an ominous move, the State Department urged reporters and other Americans to leave Iraq. The situation, said spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler, is truly dangerous. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
As the UN deadline approaches, Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams says U.S. troop strength in the Gulf has topped the 400,000 mark. That's in addition to the 265,000 troops provided by U.S. allies. Williams says U.S. forces are aware of the significance of today's deadline for Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait.
Well, the upcoming deadline should be of great concern to all Americans, and especially to citizens of the world, and in particular one citizen of the world, Saddam Hussein. He alone has the power in his hands to bring this all to a stop. He has a very clear deadline before him from the United Nations, and he is the one who can fix everything by simply starting the withdrawal process from Kuwait. It's very clear.
The Pentagon reports that Iraq now has more than 545,000 troops in Kuwait and southern Iraq. There are reports that U.S. stock exchanges are planning to close for 30 minutes if war erupts in the Gulf during trading hours. The tentative agreement made with the support of the Securities and Exchange Commission is one of a range of plans that the market regulators have drawn up. Wall Street stocks closed barely higher today in light trading as investors nervously wait for the deadline. The Dow rose nearly 7 points to 2490.59. Declines edged advances in thin trading. This is NPR. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-3 today that court supervision of public school desegregation efforts should end if a district has complied with the court's plans and if so-called vestiges of discrimination have been eliminated. But that ruling isn't sitting well with some civil rights leaders in Oklahoma City who say it is a step backward for minorities. Glenn Gardner of member station KGOU has more.
Officials with the local chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People say they're deeply disappointed but not surprised by the court's ruling. They say it reflects the conservative opinion of a court that's repeatedly ruled against minorities in affirmative action cases in recent years. The ruling came in a case involving the Oklahoma City School District. Oklahoma's NAACP president, Roosevelt Milton, says the timing of the ruling couldn't have been worse, considering the fact that today is the birthday of slain civil rights leader Martin Luther King, Jr. Longtime Oklahoma City civil rights activist Clara Luper says the court may have set back the civil rights movement for now, but she says justice can't be held back forever. For National Public Radio, I'm Glenn Gardner in Norman, Oklahoma.
Edward Shevardnadze, the foreign minister of the Soviet Union, has a successor, Alexander Besmertnik. He was voted to the post of foreign minister by parliament today. He is the former ambassador to the United States and a close associate of Shevardnadze's. The White House has welcomed Besmertnik's election. Soviet President Gorbachev has warned the secessionist Baltic republics that time for a political solution is running out. Speaking to the Soviet parliament and on national television, an angry Gorbachev said that attempts at dialogue with the pro-independence leaders of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia had brought no results. In the wake of Sunday's military assault on the Vilnius radio and television tower, which left 14 Lithuanians dead, Gorbachev is warning that the army in nearby Latvia could make some clumsy movements. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Saddam Hussein has tried to refocus attention from Iraq's occupation of Kuwait to Israel's occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. A couple of peace initiatives have linked Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait with a Mideast peace conference that would resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. For over a decade, the Israeli group Peace Now has been at the forefront of the Jewish movement advocating negotiations with the Palestinians, withdrawal from the occupied territories, and the creation of a Palestinian state. But what does Peace Now think of linking this to Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait? We called Janet Aviad, a leader of Peace Now, to find out. She spoke to me earlier today from Jerusalem.
I don't think that Saddam Hussein is a reasonable partner for any one of us to deal with, given his positions towards Israel and given his historical record. The man does not seem to want to solve problems through compromise and through negotiations, as opposed to Mubarak, let's say. Who does? It would be very, very difficult to convince an Israeli to sit down at an international conference with Saddam Hussein across the table.
But if there were a Mideast peace conference, wouldn't he be in on it one way or another?
Well, he might be. It depends on what situation he's in and what he's done in the meantime. If he gets out of Kuwait 100%, and if he renounces war with Israel and wiping Israel off the map, but when he says every day on the radio, I'm going to throw bombs into Israel, and all of Palestine for the Palestinians, right, then he's not a partner. If he says to us, as have the Palestinians, we accept state alongside state and mutual simultaneous existence recognition, then he's a partner. But he hasn't said that. The opposite. His message is really a message of war right now and the elimination of Israel. So therefore, he becomes the more radical of the Arab powers in opposition to Egypt and even Syria now, and in opposition to the Palestinians' position towards Israel, the official position, which remains the same so far as it was in November 88 in the last PNC meeting in Algiers. That's the position that we accept as the official Palestinian position towards compromise with Israel, but this is not the position of Saddam Hussein.
If there were a Mideast peace treaty that was organized, linked to Saddam Hussein's withdrawal from Kuwait, do you think that that would be starting Mideast peace negotiations with bad faith? You know what I mean, if it was linked to something Saddam Hussein initiated?
I don't think we would get Israel into the game. And I don't think that Peace Now or any peace movement would have the only peace movement that's large is Peace Now, and we wouldn't have the slightest chance of affecting Israeli public opinion on linkage. It just won't work with Saddam Hussein, given Saddam Hussein's present position. If Saddam Hussein gives into the demands that have been enunciated either by Baker or the UN, then we have another chance. But he hasn't given us the slightest, sense that he's prepared. If he makes a 180-degree change, as he could at the last minute, by the way, because he's known to make impulsive changes, then it's another story.
You know what some people have been saying? Isn't it absurd that we might go to war because people don't want to have a peace conference?
That's not the reason you're going to war. That I think is utterly ridiculous. A really distorted view of the situation. I understand the American and UN position to be the war is caused by the invasion of Kuwait and all that followed after that, and not because of an international conference. If you accept that point of view, then you've really bought... Look, Saddam Hussein did not invade Kuwait for the Palestinians. Let's get history right. The Palestinian issue was a separate issue for him. He may be concerned with it or he may not be concerned with it. He certainly didn't take, by the way, up till now, a lead position in the Palestinian issue. Suddenly he links it, and I understand why he links it from his political point of view. It's a very nice manipulation of the issue. But we shouldn't be stupid enough to fall for that. He went into Kuwait for his own reasons. He has debts, and he doesn't have enough oil in order to pay them off. So he goes into Kuwait, and Iraq has been trying to get into Kuwait for years. It's not a new issue. Then he links it to Palestine. Okay, now I'm in favor of Palestine. I'm in favor of two states. I'm in favor of talking to the PLO, but not as a result of his invasion of Kuwait. You understand it? And the Israeli peace camp on the whole is in favor of talking to the Palestinians, but tomorrow, call a peace conference, not linked to Kuwait, and we'll go to it. We will. Our government won't.
Here in the United States, there is a growing peace movement that is opposing the possible war in the Gulf. Has Peace Now been demonstrating against war? Where does Peace Now stand on the possibility of war?
The Israeli Peace Now movement, which is the center of the Peace Now movement, has not demonstrated against the war because, first of all, you have to understand the Israeli movement, that's not our issue. We're not against wars in general or wars in the region in general. Our issue is the Palestinian-Israeli issue, and Israel right now is still not in the center of the Kuwaiti conflict. So we would hope that this conflict could be ended by peace through negotiation.
Saddam Hussein has said that he would attack Israel first if Iraq is attacked by the United States. The United States has asked Israel not to attack back. Israel said that it would attack Iraq if Israel is attacked. Does Peace Now have a stand on that, or is that another issue that you're not taking a stand on?
No. If Israel is not attacked in any vital way, in other words, our position is that if a rocket lands in the beaches and doesn't touch anybody, better not to respond and not to get involved. And Israel should try not to get involved unless there is some kind of a vital attack on Israel. Our basic position is that this is not Israel's conflict and Israel should stay out. The second thing is that Israel should not use this conflict to do anything in the West Bank.
Can you expand on that?
Yes, that we would call for, we're against any military action against the Palestinians on the West Bank. There is a danger that people would use, the right-wing settlers would use the confusion of a war in order to hurt the Palestinians in some way or another. Obviously, we would oppose that, and we would be actively opposing that. So far, there's no indication that will happen, but it's something that we have to keep in mind, something about which we're very worried.
Can I ask what city you live in?
Jerusalem.
You live in Jerusalem. Can you give us a sense of what the mood is now with war such a strong possibility?
There's a general deep, deep concern. I would say from concern to panic. That is to say, there's something psychologically scary about chemical warfare, and people who were not afraid a week ago are now afraid today or just decided to take measures to try to protect themselves, such as sealing off rooms and getting the gas masks, et cetera. And that's very, very widespread. There is a sense right now that in the next 24 hours, something could happen. The likelihood is that if a rocket is thrown by Saddam Hussein as a preemptive attack on Israel, it won't be thrown into Jerusalem, but more into a totally Jewish city such as Tel Aviv. So for a change, the people in Jerusalem have a slight advantage by being closer to the Temple Mount than the people do in the centers of Israeli population, such as Tel Aviv or Haifa. But the concern is very deep now, and people are glued to the radio, as I am, waiting to hear what will happen in the next 24 hours or 48 hours.
Well, I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Janet Aviad is a leader of the Israeli group Peace Now. She spoke to us from Jerusalem. After this short break, we'll talk with a longtime American peace activist who counsels people how to stay out of the military. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Since 1923, the War Resisters League in New York has worked for peace while counseling people how to stay out of the military and out of combat. David McReynolds is the co-secretary of the group, which he joined 30 years ago. 6 months ago, people were asking him what he and other peace activists were going to do now that the Cold War was over. Today, his phones are ringing off the hook with men and women seeking advice.
There are three kinds of phone calls. One phone call in the last week, which has just paralyzed the office because there's so many of them, is there a demonstration today? Where can I go? Is there a vigil? What can I do? And the second kind of phone call, which started about 2 months ago, is, I'm in the reserves. I don't want to go. What can I do? Is there anything that I can do? Can you help me at all? Someone said that you could help me. The third, which is more recent, are parents calling saying, I think the draft might come back. What can you do to help my son stay out of the draft? And we say, look, on that last question, we want to help your son stay out, but we don't want to get your son out and then have someone else from the Black or Hispanic community go in. Let's work together to make sure the draft doesn't return and to demilitarize our society. But those are the three kinds of calls we've been overwhelmed with.
Do you think that a draft would be reinstated?
No, I think the government realizes the opposition to this war is so appallingly high and so intense so early that a draft would be widely disobeyed. They're already confronting serious problems of desertion from the military now, already, before the war has started. I don't think that, in fact, they're going to take the risks of having a draft.
So what advice are you specifically giving to people who call up and say, I'm afraid that there will be a draft and I don't want to be called up?
Our advice is that they join us in working to change a society so that our national priorities are different from sending men to the Gulf.
But you're talking long-range social change, that kind
yep.
of thing. But,
yep.
you know, there's a very specific worry. If there is a draft, you're either going to be called up or you're not. And so when people have that kind of specific concern about their future, what do you tell them?
We say it's in your interest to belong to an organization that has a track record as a pacifist group so that when you apply as a conscience objector, you have some basis for that. We would also encourage men not to register for the draft in the first place. The more men that don't register, the harder it's going to be for the government to put a draft in action. So there are two levels. One is don't register. The second is join an organization that is a pacifist organization so that if and when a draft comes, you can show that some evidence of sincerity of belief because of membership in a group opposed to all use of violence.
You've been getting phone calls from people who are in the military but don't want to fight in a war in the Gulf. What kind of grounds could they legally have for getting out of that if they volunteered to be in the Army or if they volunteered to be in the reserves?
The only legal grounds are that they are conscience objectors. And people have said, well, look, these guys knew what they were getting into when they signed up. Yes and no. For one thing, kids of 18 go through a lot of thinking processes and a lot of changes, you know, between 18, 19, and 20. And in many cases, they joined the reserves because it didn't seem like a war was likely, but the last thing they thought was that a war was going to take them to the Gulf. I mean, it's one thing to be in the National Reserve to defend the American nation against an invasion. It's a very different thing to ask a kid suddenly to go off to a monarchy where women can't even drive cars and say, hey, this is your job for the next 6 months or a year, and you may get killed. That's something that a lot of kids have enough sense to say, this isn't what we signed up for.
Are you getting any calls from people who are considering deserting? And if so, what do you tell them?
We are getting calls from men who are considering deserting, and we're telling them that there's no legal support that can be given to them, but that we will do what we did during Vietnam. We will provide shelter and help for them. But that's not there's no way people can avoid consequences of their actions. If they desert, they can't go to Canada this time, and they may end up facing federal prison. Two members of our own staff are felons from World War II, where they served prison time for refusing induction. You just can't always avoid consequences. We do support the men who are deserting, and they are calling us, yes.
How did you end up becoming a member of the War Resisters League over 30 years ago?
Well, it was a break with family tradition because my father was a lieutenant colonel in the Army and my grandfather was a lieutenant colonel in the Army, so it was something of a break. But I had moved politically to being very critical of the military, and when the Korean War came, it was also a time of choice and decision for me. And in 1949, I think it was, I registered as a conscience objector, and then got in touch with the league a year or two after that.
So what were your grounds for staying out?
At that time, my grounds were religious. I was raised as a Baptist, and as I read the New Testament, there was no way you could, in fact, be a Christian and support the use of war. Now, I've changed since then. I would not say that I was religious in an orthodox sense at all, and I wouldn't claim to be a Christian. My objection now is that I just find the use of military force to solve problems something that belongs way back in the history of humanity, and that our hope of surviving as a race, not just as a nation, but as a race, does depend on men and women increasingly breaking with the pattern of organized violence. And those would be my grounds today for opposing the use of force.
Is it more difficult for a secular person to get a conscientious objector status than it would be for someone who has religious principles that they can point to?
Yes, it would be. It would be harder.
Do you think that that's fair?
It's not fair. It's one reason that I almost went to prison back in 1952 when I was at that time still a Christian. I finally refused to answer questions about God, and my exemption was withdrawn. But the reason I wouldn't answer those questions was I had close friends who were atheists, and along with me, members of the Socialist Party of Norman Thomas. One of those went to prison for 2 years, and I thought I was taking special privilege by answering questions about God. So it is harder. We have won rights, however, over the last decade, with help from the American Civil Liberties Union. Men who are not orthodox or who are agnostic can, if they prove a philosophical opposition to the use of all organized violence, they have won the right to be classified as conscience objectors.
David McReynolds, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
David McReynolds is co-secretary of the War Resisters League in Manhattan. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what reports do you have for us as we're just a few hours away from the midnight deadline?
Hi, Terry. We'll hear from NPR's Deborah Amos in Saudi Arabia about last-minute preparations for a possible war in the Persian Gulf. I talked with Bob Simpson of the BBC from Baghdad, where he says a merchant in the old market today poured him sort of a farewell scotch instead of the usual tea. We'll have excerpts from an NPR town meeting, which was held today in Washington. Also, Ann Cooper with more on the tense situation in the Soviet Republic of Lithuania.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today's deadline for Iraq to leave Kuwait coincides with the birthday of Reverend Martin Luther King. Many peace and civil rights groups are appalled by the timing of the deadline. Reverend Emery Searcy, Jr. is executive director of Clergy and Laity Concerned, a peace group King helped form in the mid-60s. Reporter Pat Ford spoke with Searcy.
We want to get your thoughts on the tremendous irony of the sort of the deadline for war being set on the date of the birthday of a man whose life was dedicated to peace. What did you think when you heard that date?
Well, I just thought about, once again, that those people who are in positions of leadership and who should be somewhat knowledgeable of history and should incorporate all of this when they make decisions obviously was oblivious of the fact that this is the birth date of one of the leaders of our country for peace. And obviously that was absent from their thoughts and from their memory, and that was the hurting part, is that it just never really came up.
Do you think, though, that President Bush has come to realize what the date means, or do you think he still is oblivious?
I can't imagine him to be oblivious of it at this point. You have to understand, from his point of view, it would not be to his advantage to acknowledge that after the fact. I think it would have been his advantage to acknowledge the fact that, you know, that it was done probably not thinking at the moment it was Martin Luther King's birthday, and if we had known that time, we probably would have opted for another date. But then if you have a president who has found it real difficult to recognize the fact that there are 3 million homeless people in the United States, certainly, you know, that same person can overlook that little small fact.
So you feel this is a sign of a larger insensitivity to...
Oh, right, no question about it. It is a sign of a larger insensitivity to minorities. You know, it's amazing to me on how he can feel comfortable enough, you know, knowing that, number one, there is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is being an African-American. There is a large percentage of black men and women who are presently in the Persian Gulf, and in the midst of all of that have the nerve to veto a piece of civil rights legislation that could be beneficial to those people once and if and when the time comes they leave the military service. The sons and daughters of the black, poor, and working class are the ones who are on the front line protecting the lifestyles of some of the richest people in the world. But it's not inconsistent with the history of America. It's consistent. So I will say that. Then it's been consistent over the years, even though it's been wrong.
So war in the Gulf really would concern those dual issues of peace and justice, because minorities are more affected by situations like this.
Oh, absolutely. Any historian will say to you that there has not been any conflict in which minorities have not shed blood, going all the way back to the French and Indian War. Not a single one. Every one, then the minority blood has been shed. But then equality only exists on the front line. You can die equally, but it's hard to exist in this country as equals because the system will not allow it to happen.
Pat Ford spoke with Reverend Emery Searcy Jr. of Clergy and Laity Concerned, based in Atlanta. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Pat Ford, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shirock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, James Adams, the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, offers his analysis of American and Iraqi military capabilities. And we ask Harvard economist Robert Reich how America can pay for war while it's already in debt. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.